I feel honored by the fact that you have come to share with us the studies in the Lord's Word. We should all feel honored the Lord has seen fit to share with us the beauty of the books of prophecy, which give us insight not only to what has happened, but to those things yet ahead for us in this world in which we live. We have so many things we've talked about already that had, to me, been very interesting and very informative, and we still have ahead of us some very lovely insights into things that the Lord wanted us to know about. Some of those things we're going to talk about later on in our studies have to do with the modern day in which we live and some of the events that we have recently seen and are seeing in the world around us. I'm not trying to imply by what I'm about to read that you're going to read of the nation of Iraq or of Sudan, of some of the leaders that you recently heard about in history. But we're going to tie some of those things together later on that might in some way let you see whether God knew about these things and had them in mind. But there is an article which was given to me a moment ago to read to the audience here today. And I think that the essence of what it says certainly is interesting because it does tie in with the fact that God has throughout the ages known what was to develop. He's seen fit to have his hand present in everything the world has ever seen or been confronted with in one way or another. And the writer of this letter to the editor from Sierra Vista was R.A. Dyer, and he expressed, I think, very, very well something that should be known and seen. And later on in our studies, you'll see how this does have some relationship to it. If you like, you can believe that communism and the Berlin Wall came crashing down in Europe at just the right time to erase our fear of Russia and free our troops to be able to move to the Gulf, just a coincidence. You can believe that the half a million American troops could go to war for 6 weeks, destroy an enemy that outnumbered them in combat 5-1, which was just luck. You can believe that amazing forethought and planning by our previous administrations for superior technology and equipment just happened to be provided in time for the war was more luck. You can believe that 40 Scud missiles could be fired into the center of Israel's population center without hitting hardly anyone, just accidental. You can believe that our troops being able to see at night through oil, blackened smoke while the enemy cannot was not very important. You can believe that just being blessed with a wise, patient, and strong president who happened to have brilliant generals and planners was very fortunate. You can believe having brave men who had been extremely well trained and prepared for combat was not something that took much planning. You can believe that getting 28 nations to come together and stick with it, even though many had different goals than ours, was ordinary. But I believe historians are going to have a terrible time trying to record all of these amazing things without giving some credit to God. I believe that God's great overall plan for creation and for mankind is proceeding on his schedule. I believe that the tremendous outpouring of prayer from this nation was heard in heaven and that all praise and honor and credit for a short, easy war should go to him and him alone. Give thanks. Some thoughts very to the point, I believe, and some that are going to be important as we continue in our studies and this interesting information God's given us about Daniel and Revelation and the times of prophecy, so long past, but which are being fulfilled in our day. Some of you have not been here earlier in our studies, and I think I need to review because of your presence. It's been unusual because during this study we have not had to review too much because most of those attending have been here just about every service. And so we've had to do very little summary. But this morning it'll be different because we do have some who haven't been here, and so we need to do that. And briefly we'll summarize what we have said. What we have said, and I think is very evident from our study thus far, is that prophecy, as interesting as it may be, is spoken in symbolic language. Things are given to us in word pictures which portray something that was to be true and right and real and exact, but the fact is they're not stated just exactly in the form or time or arrangement that would be so easy for us to read as a comic book or a newspaper article just as we've read. And so it's given in picturesque language. Language of prophecy is right It's exact. It's true. It's given by God, and it means exactly what it says. But it's said in terms that if we take it for exactly what it seems to say, we'll have all kind of weird images and beast and contract and all kind of conglomerations of things that just don't fit, make sense at all. But he's using these as symbols of something that they represent, which are real, actual events. Later on, as men were able to see these things that were going on in the world in which they were living, and as time developed and rolled forward, they begin to record these events. A number of men have come on the scene, Herodotus and a number of others back in ancient times, as well as in more modern times, such men as Josephus and the Maccabees and others who lived and wrote about those books. And then even from that time forward, we have some such as in our own day, H.G. Wells and others, who have written of a number of those events. So taking their words, and note this, they were not always Christians. They were not always believers in some religion. Many times they were atheists. But the fact still remains, they recorded history. They wrote what they saw. They wrote what they had gleaned from those before them, so that books of history give us knowledge of what has happened. Prophecy, then, is that which was, by God's point of view, going to happen. And history is a record from man's point of view of what did happen. And a beautiful way to understand prophecy is not quite so difficult as we might think. But if we will lay prophecy down, as it were, on a table, and beside it lay the works of history, then history tell us what prophecy was all about. So that history, then, is the key to unlocking prophecy. If we know history, if we allow history to be used as a beautiful tool it is to let us know where we stand and what has taken place, then prophecy begins just to unfold in a lovely way, and we can see precisely where we are in God's scheme of things. Now, we've shown in the book of Daniel, in a number of places, that there were to come on the scene four kingdoms: Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. In the days of the Roman Caesars, there was to be a little stone cut out without hands. It was to strike this last kingdom, or as pictured by Daniel chapter 2, the feet of a great image. It was to break in pieces all these kingdoms. It was to grow and consume the entire world. And unlike the other kingdoms, it was to stand forever. Now, God through Daniel very plainly tells us that was the kingdom of God or the Lord's church. Now, later on in Daniel and also in Revelation, he tells us that really there were to be seven kingdoms, not merely four. And then later on, he tells us there will be two kingdoms of these four, or of these seven. And then later on in Revelation, he tells us there's to be an eighth kingdom involved as well. Now, I'm not saying that to be confusing, but simply to show that Daniel, as and John, as the time allows them to do so, through God's blessings, seems to take a spotlight and shines the spotlight on certain elements of this overall picture as God saw fit for him to reveal it to us. So that Daniel chapter 2, and then chapter 7, 8, 9, and then chapters 11 and 12 give us beautiful insight onto these overall kingdoms and which one was at that particular time important. Now, God is doing very simply showing us that from the earliest time of God's people as an identified group, which was Israel, went into Egyptian bondage, came by that, they were conquered in 721 by the Assyrians, in 587 by the Babylonians, and then in turn they were taken control of after the Babylonians lost their power by Persia, by Greece, by Rome. So Rome was on the scene, as God very plainly tells us, when Jesus Christ came to the earth. There he died upon the cross, bringing into being his kingdom, which was to be a kingdom unlike any other kingdom from several points of view, but particularly in that it was not to fail and to be consumed by other kingdoms after it. But the Lord's kingdom was to, and notice this importantly, it was to be established and it was to stand forever. We're going to see problems, as we have already seen in the Lord's church. We're going to see that the church, it appeared all in those vanished in the face of the earth. But later in our studies, likely about next Friday, you're going to see some beautiful insight from history as to what happens to the Lord's church. The Lord's church was going to stand forever, and someday, when this world comes to an end and time itself comes to an end, the church is still not going to pass away. The church of which you are and which consists of you as part of it is someday going to be delivered from this world, the problems of it, into heaven, and will continue there forever and forever and forever. The church will never die. It'll change locations, but it'll never die. And that's the beauty of these studies, because it lets us see God's providential hand in all of this, even as this article someone handed me a while ago to read, shows that God's hand is in everything around us. Don't think for a moment God doesn't know what's going on, because he absolutely does, and in a marvelous way protects and cares for his people. And that, again, too, is another summary of the book of Revelation. Because in Revelation, we saw last night, God is present always with his people and is behind the scene, giving them guidance and instruction and comfort, and giving them assurance that they will be blessed. As the book of Revelation now comes on the scene and begins to unfold itself for us, in the sense that Christ has in his hand a book or scroll, and this book begins to be unfolded little by little, and each seal as it's broken reveals to us some event of world history was to take place. He tells us about seven seals of that book, and he tells us about seven trumpets. He's going to tell us then about seven vials, which are yet to come. We'll talk about those later on. So the middle portion of Revelation tells us about three major divisions of time, which we basically have called the Christian Age. And each of these succeed each other, and there is a progression forward in time from the beginning of the church in 30 A.D. until the end of time. Now, it's just that simple. I don't mean by that to say that it's not picturesque language. It is. It's in word pictures. It's in symbols. It's in terms that we would not at all recognize did we not have world history to interpret it for us. But it's simple in that it's not a thing in the world but a map, just a map of the Christian age, and begins to unfold itself item after item, event after event, country after country, leader after leader, date after date. And you can just take world history, just an ancient world history, start at page one, Levite Evolution. We start at the beginning of it. You can see the world history book just unfolding, and see in all those pages what God has already told us in the book of Revelation. We start at 30 A.D. at the beginning of the Lord's church. And then if you notice from what's on the board already, we have a progression part in date from 30 A.D. until 337. Now today we're going to go in our studies a little farther than that. We're going to go up to 782 today. Now tonight we're going to go even farther than that and have a very, very beautiful in-depth study on the next event that comes forth in the world. As we see though, the first part of Revelation talks about the fall of pagan Rome. Now Rome was a source of threat and harm for God's people in that paganism was predominant. Now Israel and the country around it where Christianity began was way to the east, but Rome had power over the then known world, and paganism was the religion that it fostered and that it sustained and supported. But God saw fit to bring paganism to its knees, and he did so in time by allowing Constantine to come to the scene and eventually to outlaw paganism and to install Christianity as the religion of the empire. Now while this was good, in that it allowed Christianity to flourish and to be accepted and persecution to be at a minimum, it also was bad in that when Christianity becomes easy and it doesn't take any force or effort to be a Christian, then Christianity seems to become a watered-down element and does not have the strength and the power it had when it was difficult. So we're going to see then that the imperial state of Rome now emerges, and it becomes a very powerful force, but eventually God brings it to an end too. And then from there arises another phase of Rome as history continues on. Basically, then, what we're seeing is that the Christian age is unfolded before us. John in chapter 1 talks to us about the Lord's Day. As we suggested to those who've been here earlier, don't become confused by the use of a traditional term which you have heard all your life, and I have all mine, and our forefathers have too, and that's the statement that the Lord's Day is Sunday, or Sunday is what John calls the Lord's Day. I don't have time to go into it this morning because we spent quite a long while the other day upon it, but where, anywhere in the entire Bible, do you find the Lord's Day defined as Sunday? Had a friend one time said, well, it's right there in Revelation 1:10. Well, is it? Look at 1:10 and see. It says the Lord's Day, plainly says the Lord's Day, but it does not say it was Sunday. Does not imply it was Sunday. Does not even suggest it was Sunday. Does not allow the opportunity for it to be Sunday. John says, in effect, that I was in a frame of spiritual mind that I could see the Lord's day unfolded before me while I was on the Isle of Patmos. That's not a quotation, of course, but that's my idea of what's taking place. John simply, through spiritual eyes, was able to see the Lord's day unfolded before him. And Christ spoke of the day that was his, which Abraham, his forefather, would love to have seen, and did see through faith. Then we've seen the seven churches of Asia being seven real churches, which did exist. They existed in a spot that has an overall appearance of a circle. And for some reason, God saw fit to let those be the seven churches of all the many churches he could have selected, let those be the seven. Now, just north of there was Troas, which he left out. And just to the southeast was Colossae, which he also left out. The question we raised was, why did God leave those two out? Now, we're not questioning God. He didn't have to put them in. He didn't have to put these seven in. He could have done something else. We're not trying to question God. But the fact is, he used seven, which is a number of completeness, as he used in a number of other places that explained. It seems that he used these seven churches to give us insights and things we need to know and use those as example churches for us. Not only did he use these example churches which really existed, but why would all of a sudden he take seven churches which needed correction or encouragement and insert letters to them right in the middle of a book of prophecy? It wouldn't fit. It doesn't seem to have any logical reason for being there, unless it's something we've been missing. I think it is. It seems to me what he's saying is these seven churches actually represent seven eras of time pictured by the qualities he describes them as having, which would be the entire age of Christianity divided into seven sections. Thus, if we look at the church at Ephesus, we see it was one where there was a beginning of growth and prosperity of Christianity. Then there was in the church at Smyrna martyrdom, which the church went through during the days of pagan Rome. God brought them to an end. Thus, we came out of martyrdom and then into a church that began to flourish and grow. And therefore, Pergamos pictures a time of drift and digression which the church went into. And eventually, there came a time of utmost corruption. It flourishes in the kingdom of God. The church of our Lord is torn apart by the devil's presence in it, and all kind of evil and corruption and sin, and even a reversion to paganism arises during the time of Thyatira. And then the church begins to split apart into sections called sects or denominations. We picture that by Sardis. And then the church at Philadelphia pictures the time, as the word itself denotes, brotherly love. So there we see the Lord's church returning to its first love, which it had begun to lose over here. So the church returned to its first love. Now, I want you to be here for that. Because when we talk about Philadelphia, we're going to see some things that are just spectacular. Some things that history tells us about, some things that involve you and me. And I mean us. I don't mean us in a sense of just being part of a multitude of things we can put ourselves into. But it talks about us, really. The congregation here. It talks about the congregations in our nation. It talks about the people that we are directly associated with and the work that we are doing. Oh, it doesn't mention John, Bill, Mary, Jane, and those who are sitting in the audience. It doesn't mention those names, but it talks about the very work that we are involved in, and in a beautiful way. And then from there, we see that the Lord's church goes into a great deal of indifference and compromise and watering down, which is where the world stands today, particularly the church in the world stands. So the seven churches, I feel, picture seven eras of time into which the Christian age was to have been divided, and now we have seen each of those develop to where we are in the last stage of it today. Now, I could take about 5 hours and probably bring this a little closer to home that you see it. But we've already talked about 8 or 9 hours, maybe 10 already, and so you see I can't summarize any farther today. But I do trust it's giving you a general view of where we stand. Last night, we talked about pagan Rome coming to an end. We showed that pagan Rome, pictured as that element which was necessary to remove, and God saw fit to do it very beautifully, had four horses come on the scene. These represented the four qualities that were Rome's, and he called the last of the horse of death. Then there followed a great deal of persecution, the Bible tells us, in the days of Domitian, between 303 and 313 A.D. After that, paganism failed because God allowed Constantine, who was a secular ruler, but he favored Christianity. His mother, as history tells us, likely became a Christian. The Church of Sophia in Istanbul, which is now a mosque for the Muslims, was built in her honor. And this brings an end to pagan Rome, and Christianity now begins to flourish and spread throughout the Roman Empire. That brings us now to chapter 8. Chapter 8 tells us that when he had opened the seventh seal, and I need to show by the seals that these seven seals, which allow this book to be bound in a way it cannot be read, are opened one by one. Now, we've talked about six of these seals thus far, and the seventh seal doesn't really tell us anything in detail, such as the other six has, but what it does when it's open, it shows us there are seven trumpets. Now, as we look at these seven trumpets begin to be blown one by one, we're going to hear six of those blow, and then the seventh, when it blows, again, is not going to tell us an event, such as the other six have. It's going to reveal something else, followed by it, called seven vials. As you see, we are in a progress forward of unfolding things the Lord wants us to see. Verse 1 says, when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. The silence here, I think, is something that is beautiful to see, because the Lord is allowing us to experience in spiritual matters something like we see also in secular matters, natural matters around us. Some time ago, we had a very bad hurricane come through the southern coast of our nation. And we have a number of brethren who live right in the path of where that hurricane was to be. And it happens all along down there. Some of the brethren here have been there, and they know very, very well the brethren at Freefield. When the hurricane came through, there was all kind of devastation. Of course, very strong winds, roofs were blown off, trees were uprooted, and all kind of things were done. But as this force passed through, the radio and other means of communication warned everybody there, don't leave your houses. Now, they've been expecting the hurricane for days. And, of course, when the hurricane passes through, what you want to do is immediately run out and see if your dog got killed or if your car had a tree on top of it or whatever happened, because you're secure inside wherever you can be to escape the high winds and the rain and the lightning and the tornadoes that come from it. So everybody's secured here. When this great force passes over, the tendency is to run outside and see what happens. But of course, they're warned, as they always do in hurricanes, don't leave. Stay where you are. Don't move. Because what has happened is you're simply in the eye of the hurricane. The first wave has gone. But then the second part is coming very shortly, perhaps in 30 minutes. And it'll be a devastating force too. So don't move. Stay right where you are. So there's a calm in the middle of a hurricane. And as it passes over, then you can expect a second onslaught of destruction. For you see, it's like an extremely large tornado. It has a force that goes round and round, sometimes well over 100 miles an hour. And the outside edge, both in the front and in the rear, is where the damage is done. In the middle, there's a calm. So here we have seen the onslaught against paganism. Now we have a calm. There's going to be another great force come through, but there's a calm right now. And this calm, he says, takes place for 30 minutes. Of course, not real 30 minutes. We have a space of half an hour now that there's a calm. There's peace, and the Lord's church is in a quintuple condition. Then I saw seven angels which stood before God, and then were given seven trumpets. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and it was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. We mentioned earlier in our studies that back in the Old Testament, incense was offered, and it brought a sweet-smelling savor to the nostrils of God. Of course, I think we should say here that God doesn't really have a nose, our eyes, our ears, our feet, our hands, as we think of it. So in Revelation, here I'm getting off on those tangents we're talking about earlier. You can start in these studies, you can just go any direction and talk for an hour if you want to. As a long word, but that long, it's called anthropomorphism. That simply means that we attribute to God the characteristics of human beings. And in the Bible, when it talks about the characteristics of God, such as his smelling incense, don't think for a moment that God smells like you do. We are created in the image of God, but that does not mean that we look like God. For God did not have a physical body. Nor do angels. Angels can take a human form if necessary, and God can take a human form if he needs to. But he is not, by essence, a human, or have a body, or bones, or blood as we do. But we're created in the image of God in that we are created in the likeness of God in that we are eternal, we are a spirit, we have a will, right or wrong, and we have the control of ourselves in making a decision that has to do with eternity. So in that sense, we are like God. And so when we attribute to God human characteristics such as eyes, our ears to hear, our nose to smell, we are attributing to God, by virtue of words, a characteristic that we can understand. We're not really saying God has ears or eyes, but God, in order to make ourselves understand Him, is pictured as a human. So here when it talks about the prayers ascending up from the altar before God as incense, it simply lets us understand that God is aware of what we're doing. He is pleased with the honor and the praise we give Him, and our prayer is that source, like incense was, that approaches God. And that's the reason prayer is so important. And I commend you, brethren, here for your desire to pray often and to pray sincerely and to pray about specific things that are needed as opposed to just a general, not heartfelt prayer. You do well in that area, and we appreciate that. He goes further and says, the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it into the earth. Now, this is an opposite approach. We have a censer. We have this vessel which is filled with fire from the altar of God. And it's cast on the earth. And when it does, when that's done, it gives the effect of something that's hateful and that expresses vengeance and expresses a desire of whoever receiving this to rebel, as you'll see. He cast it into the earth, and there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. Now, by this, we understand God's about to take vengeance again and about to destroy the forces of evil which have arisen and which now at this time need to be taken care of. However, we've noticed earlier that in chapter 7, there was to be a sealing of the saints. And we've noticed earlier in chapter 7, there were to be four winds which were to be held back lest they blow and destroy some things God did not want destroyed. Now, in our next verse, we're going to read where there's destruction, a very great destruction upon the forces of evil. But God saw fit to seal His servants in their forehead so that they would not be blown away. Seal His servants, I shouldn't say in the forehead, later on that comes, but not now. He seals His servants, and they're to be secure because these four winds, when they're unleashed, are going to blow away whatever in front of them. I described last night the sealing up of Houston, Texas at one time when I was passing through because they were expecting a hurricane. And we do that in our part of the country when there's a great hurricane. We don't have to where I live, but down south they do. We get just the tail end of the winds, and we have a lot of rain, and it's real good for us, but it's certainly bad for those 300 years miles below there. So they take sheets 4x8 of plywood, they put over the windows, and everything they can nail down or tie down, they do, because the wind's coming through. Now, those who don't take care of those things have their windows blown out. They have all kinds of things blown out of the yards, and they never see them again. The roofs of barns are torn off by the high winds. But if they secure these things, then they have a way of being more secure and more safe when the destructive forces come. Now, God doesn't want His people to be blown away. He's already protected them from paganism. It's been destroyed that, but another great onslaught of winds is going to come. Four of those, in fact, northeast, south, and west. So it's going to be all-encompassing in regard to the Roman Empire. I didn't say this today. I guess I should do so. We're talking about the center of the then-known world. The Mediterranean simply means the sea in the middle of the world because all the known world around it is all those people knew about. And so everything that centers in our study centers around this part of the world. Now, later on in Revelation, it's going to extend beyond that. But right now, this is all the world knows about. So the Mediterranean is what we're speaking of. So the four winds, the northeast, south, and west, and we're going to talk about those this morning and tonight because all directions are seen in our study. So as these winds are unleashed to destroy the Roman Empire, God's people must not be destroyed, so God seals them. He nails them down and ties them down. There's a period of time for this to occur. And so when they're tied down and nailed down and secured to where they won't be blown away, then, when that happens, God allows these winds to come. And that's what we see in the next verse. Verse 6. The seven angels which had the seven trumpets had themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and a third part of trees was burnt up. All green grass was burnt up. Now, since we're making a forward progress in history, what we know then is we go from 30 AD, which we're going to talk about, the Church. We've gone through the era of paganism being destroyed from, first of all, 180, then 204, and then 313, when there was the Edict of Toleration issued and the great persecution stopped. And then when the Roman Empire had its center of government moved from Rome to Constantinople in 326, and then when Constantine died in 337, we come to an end of that. So as we progressively come forward, naturally what we look for then is not something that happened before then, or not something way out here somewhere, but the next thing we look at in world history is simply something that must have taken place shortly beyond that time, which tied in with Christianity. Now, there no doubt were a lot of things that happened, perhaps in Egypt, or maybe over in Afghanistan, or maybe over in Canada even, that they didn't know a thing about back in those days. But the fact still remains, it had to be something that applied to those people, to that time, to that situation. The very next thing we see in world history is that from the north, from way up in Germany and that part of Europe, there were a barbaric group of people called the Goths. These Goths now, and the first time any great invasion has occurred, the Goths began to come down in 410 from the north and invaded Rome and took Rome. You notice that on the map and on the pages you have in front of you, where the Goths is pictured by this green arrow. They come down to Rome. They take Rome. They sack Rome. They do with Rome what they want to do. And it says here that a third part of trees was burned out. Watch the third very closely, because that's important. So one third of green grass and such like were destroyed. Most of you, I don't suppose, are too familiar with the Civil War and the part that it had to do with my part of the country. Of course, it touched Missouri and Texas. It had to do also even in Mexico, but that's a part of the story that most of us are not familiar with. But back in my part of the country, Sherman, General Sherman, was commissioned to come through that part of the world and to literally bring the South to its knees, and he did. He came through his army. He just burned a road, a wide highway, all the way through Georgia, from Atlanta to the sea. I have not done so, but I understand that if you know what to look for, you can fly today over with an airplane over that area of Georgia, and you can actually see where he burned his way through. I haven't done that. I have heard that it can be done, but you can see the remains of that many, many places. He was trying to bring the South to its knees, and of course he did. Nobody in the South likes him, but everybody up north thought he did a marvelous deed. I guess it's going to which way you look at it. And that's what's happening here. Here the Goths come from the north, and they take advantage of everything in their way and do all they can to try to bring Rome to its knees, and they sack it and take what they can back to where they're from and enjoy the spoils of their victory. The man who led them was a man whose name was Alaric. They were from where there were plenty of trees and water, and they did not need to worry too much about the saving of or the restoration of anything they harmed, because there was plenty of it there, so it's not anything unnatural at all for them to burn their way through and destroy all the vegetation and such like as they come. Now, that doesn't seem to be important right now. Later on it will, because later on we're going to see where other armies were very careful about these kind of things, but this particular army did not. Well, when they had taken what they wanted from Rome, they turned around and they went back. Now, that's important, too. They came to Rome, they defeated Rome, and then they went back home, leaving Rome in shambles. Verse 89 says, "And the second angel sounded his trumpet, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood." We need to comment on the word mountain, first of all. Last night, we talked about mountains and how that a mountain or an island in Bible prophecy, does not necessarily mean what you think of as a huge mound of dirt and rocks with trees on it and sometimes without on it. But it represents kingdoms, great or small. Isaiah chapter 2 talks about the Lord's church as being a great mountain. And a number of other places also talk about mountains. This is compared to Daniel chapter 2, verse 25, where there he talks about the Lord's church, this little stone that came a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So you see, we're not talking about a geographical location here. We're not talking about a mountain that you can call by name. We're talking about a kingdom. So this great mountain is cast to the sea. What he's doing, of course, is telling us there's another kingdom coming, and this kingdom is going to have effect not upon the land as the Goths did, but upon the sea and upon the waters. And the third part of the sea became blood. third part. Well, we have two-thirds, don't we? So he says, this time the next invasion was from the sea. And sure enough, there were some people who came in from over in Southeast Asia at this time. They don't know a whole lot about their origin, but they came from somewhere in the east, probably up on the other side of the Caspian Sea, over toward where today we would see the western edge of China. And as they came through, they began to conquer everything in their path. They came through Central Europe. They came down to the Straits of Gibraltar. They crossed there, and they came on over to where later on we know of a place named Carthage. And they stopped there. They stopped there for 25 years and did not proceed on because, as you well can see from the map, they were at a point of where the Mediterranean Sea was a great expanse of water. Now, they came through the Straits of Gibraltar with no trouble, of course, being small as it was, in 429. They stopped at Carthage, and then they built ships. And during the next 25 years, they were able to prepare themselves an armada of ships on which they put their soldiers, and then they sailed to Rome. Exactly, in history, what John knew 400 years before. I wonder how John knew that. Who gave me this clipping this morning? Was it you, Bob? Well, I don't mean to glorify the clipping, except for the fact that whoever wrote this had in mind that God must have been behind these things. Well, of course, God had to be behind John because John would have known this otherwise. What we're saying is simply divine, in that God knew this was going to happen, God said it was going to happen, and history 400 years later tells us that it did happen exactly like he said it would. So the Vandals come down now. They invade the area of Rome from the sea. They go up the Tiber River, and they invade Rome by the sea. The man who was at the head of their movement is called Genesaric. And the word vandalism, which is mentioned in your insurance policies, and is found in your newspaper articles quite often, the word vandalism is a very common word to you. This is exactly where it came from. As they came down, they vandalized, because they were vandals, and that's how we coined that term, the area of Rome. We coined a lot of our terms from things that happened in world history. So they conquered Rome, they sacked it, and they went back home too. Verse 10 and verse 11 tells us something else happened. The third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. It fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of water. The name of the star is called Wormwood. The third part of the waters became wormwood or bitter. And many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. Now, since we're going progressively forward in our studies, we know that whatever's going to happen here now must surely happen in the future from the time we just talked about. And sure enough, that's what happens. Now, Rome has been sacked twice. And the first Attila, the first leader of the Goths who came on the scene, Alaric, died some 8 days after he conquered Rome, but his army went back and they were successful. The second has come in and sacked Rome again, and they've gone back also, but now we see a third invasion come on the scene, and this was in 440, but you notice now that this star falls upon waters, but this time not the sea, but upon the rivers, the heads of waters in Central Europe. And it's spoken of as being bitter because, of course, that's the effect that's seen in Rome because of the invasion here. This man's name is Attila, and as you might well know, the name of the people are the Huns. They come, too, again, from Southeast Asia, but probably a little south from where the second invasion occurred. And they go on the heads of the waters in Europe, and eventually they touch Rome themselves, too. And they, like the others before them, sack Rome, and then they, too, leave. But let's see what happens about that. As they came down to approach Rome, they went through a number, and history records this. For some reason, history bears out where they fought and the places they met the Roman army and how they defeated the Roman army. And listen to the terms I'm going to read to you. They came from Central Asia. They halted at the Danube. Then they went west and they crossed the Rhine. They crossed the river Marne. They met the Roman army there. Then they turned south and again met the Roman army at the Rhone River and later on at the Po River in 451 in Italy. History records the names of these rivers where their battles were fought, signifying precisely what God knew and said through John 400 years before. So the first army was by land, the second by sea, the next now had its great engagements with the Roman army on the rivers, the heads of the waters in Central Europe. They sacked Rome, and then they turned, and they went back. But as they came to Rome, how it was sacked is different from the first two. Attila was approached by Leo I, who was the bishop of Rome at that time, as world history calls him. He was, I think, probably a very wise man. He probably was able to understand the mysticism that he might be facing there, and the fact that there were so many unlearned men at the head of movements such as Attila was. And so he approached him and said, in effect, "Now Rome is yours, and you can take Rome. But there was a man not long ago who came to Rome, and he sacked Rome, and he died 8 days later." Now, he didn't say this, but in effect, he said, "Do you want to take a chance on dying too?" That's the effect it had. And so Attila decided not to go into Rome. But what the people of Rome did was to bring the spoils out of gift to him so that they were not harmed, but he got what he wanted. He turned around, he went back toward home, but he didn't go back home because he stopped somewhere about where that number three is on the board, and he liked what he saw at a place that they later on named Hungary. And so the Huns stopped there at Hungary. The remnants of those people are there today. And they have a capital which name is Budapest, and that's where they ended up and still are today. It's a very interesting story. I don't suppose that anyone, except by means of world history and perhaps minor history at that, knows a great deal about it. But Attila was so liked by his soldiers that when he died, as the story is, they changed the course of the Danube River. They buried his body in the bed of the river, and then allowed the river to return over. So that, in a sense, the Danube River is a marker for his grave. Now, that's a pretty story, and I think it shows honor that his soldiers must have had for him, but the fact is that apparently just not exactly the truth. I like to double-check the things I say because you can hear so many tales and so many things are not exactly right, and historians have a tendency of not always getting things exactly right. Many times they do, many times they don't. Many times they incorporate hearsay and legends into their stories. So I've double-checked this with two people I knew who were from Hungary, and in both cases they told me emphatically it was not the Danube River. Even though history books say that, even though books about Attila say that, they say emphatically it's not. They say we reared in school, we know our background, our history, this has been our nation for centuries, and the story is true, but it was not the Danube River. And they pointed out to me where the river was, how it intersects with the Danube, but the name of that river is spelled T-I-S-Z-A. It's a much smaller river than the Danube and would be much easier to divert the stream. So based upon my contact with those who are from Hungary and who are reared with this background, both of them telling me emphatically it was not the Danube, but it was the other river, I must go on that for information because they were raised there and they apparently knew what was going on. But the fact is now it tells us that there was a third of these rivers affected. So the Huns now come down, and we have the third mentioned. Now as we turn to our next reference, verse 12, the fourth angel sounded, and a third, fourth angel, third part. Now let's see, we ought to have three thirds. Well, let's go on. The fourth angel sounded, and a third part of the sun was smitten, and a third part of the moon, and a third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. As you remember last night in our studies, we had the sun, the moon, and the stars in consideration. Except for you who were not here last night, I would not need to say this, but I must now because you'll be confused if I don't. The sun, the moon, and the stars in Daniel Revelation, almost if not every time, do not mean the sun, the moon, the stars as you see them outside. And very rarely in prophecy do these type expressions mean the actual sun, the moon, or the stars. As we discussed last night, they are symbols spoken in picturesque language of actual situations, but they're spoken of to show the greatness and the power and the magnificence of the heavenly bodies. So that we're speaking here, of course, of leaders, world-dominating leaders and powers, and the sun would be the supreme, the moon would be lesser, and the stars would be even more smaller than that. And among several references, one of the, I think, best references is way back over in the book of Genesis, where Joseph dreams dreams and sees visions, and he was so despised by his brothers they eventually sold him into slavery. But on one occasion he dreamed that there was the sun and the moon and the 11 stars which bowed in obeisance to him. And his father Jacob very plainly said and understood that, Joseph, do you mean I'm the sun and your mother is the moon and the 11 brothers are the stars and we're going to be in submission to you? That's exactly what Joseph meant. That's exactly what God meant for him to see, and that's exactly what happened. So see, in this case, the sun, the moon, the stars were his own family. The father, the mother, and the brothers. Now here's what we're finding too, the same thing. We're finding that we're not talking about the real sun, the moon, the stars that we see in the heavens around us, but we are seeing the greatness that one Rome one time was come to naught. The fact that it controlled the entire world and all roads led to Rome, and Rome was the center of learning, of riches, of power, of glory. It dominated the entire world, and now it's about to be toppled. And God uses the sun, the moon, the stars to signify this. And each of those had to do with a third. And each of those had to do with the going out of the sun, the moon, and the stars. And they fall. Well, since Rome has already been invaded three times, it's literally been brought to its knees and not much left there at all, then you might suspect the fourth invasion, too, would not have a lot to do, and it doesn't. Because in 476, one of the Roman generals who is leading a band of people in southern Germany, one of Rome's armies, decides that he will come down and he himself now will invade Rome. His name is Otiesa. He leads a people called the Heruli, and they make the invasion to Rome, and this time they take Rome. They conquer Rome. They subdue Rome. Rome's own army takes over, but they don't go away. They stay there. You see the difference? The first three invasions came to Rome. They defeated Rome and went back home. They left Rome. It becomes weaker and weaker and weaker. But now Rome is completely destroyed by means of, completely undone by means of an invading army taking over and staying there and become now known of as Italy. And this becomes the king of Italy. So finally Rome, you see, is destroyed in the sense of its power and glory and might and majesty, but Rome as a city still stays there. Well, we've mentioned some things here that I think are important. Well, first of all, we've seen that there have been four one-thirds mentioned. Now, that's just not possible. If you happen to be a math teacher or sitting in a math teacher's class, she might want to describe to you fractions. She'd say, well, you see this big old red apple? I'm going to cut it into three pieces. Now, these three pieces all make one apple. Each of these pieces is one third. Of course, three thirds always make an apple. I don't care if you have 10 tenths or 7/7, it makes a whole when you have all 7 or all 10 there. But in this case, it's number 3. When you have 3/3, you have a whole. Now, didn't God know that? Why did he mention here the third 4 times? He did. He mentioned this third, this third, this third, and this third. And that's quite often the way our minds go when we read prophecy. We think in terms of 3/3 and a whole, and we have 1/3 left over. Just don't do it that way, do you? Just doesn't work. You'd have failed math if you looked at it that way, because that just doesn't fit with any schedule or pattern at all of our thinking. But here he mentions 1/3 of all of these things were done away. You see, you have the land, the sea, the rivers of water, and now the sun, moon, and stars. 1/3 of all of those are done away, it says, apparently. No, not quite. What we're doing is looking at it the wrong way. Now, it's true we have 4/3 mentioned, but what we're saying is the same 1/3 is just spoken about 4 times. Because what we're talking about is the 1/3 of the Roman Empire, which under consideration. It had 4 invasions, and 4 people came, and Rome is brought to its knees, but only that one-third of the Roman Empire. Because, you see, the Roman Empire is divided in three parts. That's later on we're going to find out. So we don't have a contradiction here. We don't have a problem here at all. What we simply have is God knew ahead of time what he's talking about. He brings Rome to its knees, the one-third of the Roman Empire. But there were four invasions that did that. You see how easy a prophecy fits together? Like those little pieces of a puzzle. And when you put them in a proper place, they just all make a beautiful picture, and they don't clash. I don't say this to be harsh or harmful or critical unduly of anyone. But in prophecy, we just can't make out of it something spectacular and dramatic in a way that just catches people's attention to give all kind of weird images and idols and beasts and lightnings and thunderings and horns. All those kind of things are simply symbolic language that has to do with an actual historical fact and is not nearly as complicated as we make it. So these four-thirds simply mean it's the one-third of Rome, the western one-third of Rome, that is now subdued. There are two more to go, as we'll well see and as he will bring out. You say I could have an extra hour today? 15 more minutes. Well, okay. I would like to go a little farther because we have an extremely interesting part of our study coming up. But in all fairness, I really would like to have longer than 15 minutes. I believe I'll just stop right now. Did that surprise you? It would surprise anybody who's been here because before this time I've talked at least an hour and 15 minutes every time. But we do have a very beautiful section to cover in the first part of chapter 9. And then the second part, we're going to see some things that will utterly surprise us and bring us to just an enormous understanding of some beautiful pictures the Lord has in mind in the last part of the ninth chapter. So, Lord willing, we'll talk on chapter 9, I hope in its completeness tonight. I may talk an hour and a half, but it'll be worth coming to, not because of me, but because of beautiful things we're going to see in that chapter. So we'll talk about chapter 9, Lord willing, tonight. But verse 13 says, "And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth." Now, that's not Christians. Remember, we've already suggested the fact that when in the Bible you read about harm and destruction and pain and anguish and sorrow in Daniel and Revelation, don't for a minute get upset, because that's not talking about you. The book of Revelation, Daniel, give us beautiful assurances of knowing that God is going to protect his people and we are in his mind. He's not going to let us be harmed. Oh, I don't mean we won't be killed, or I don't mean that we won't suffer some of the consequences of harm of those around us. But the fact is, the thrust of this is not against us, but it's against the world around us who are influenced by the devil. So this woe he's speaking of comes to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. So these first four angels, spoken of as the loosing of the winds on Rome proper, have blown, and Rome has been subdued. But now there are three other angels yet to sound. One has to do with the number 5, the other has to do with number 6, and we won't talk about the 7th for a long time yet. It won't blow for quite a long while. But these next two are going to blow tonight. So we'll have the 6 trumpets blown tonight, and the next two problems we're going to face, we'll discuss at that time. You've been so kind to come and listen. We appreciate that very much, and do hope we can encourage you to be with us tonight. It's been suggested that every once in a while I say something, and I'll say, watch for this, and be sure, and in a moment we're going to talk about it. And then I never talk about it. Well, what I failed to do is simply, I don't tell you when I talk about it. We decided a while ago that what I ought to do when I get to that kind of point is click my heels together and wave at you so you know. Well, sometimes I forget. Sometimes I'll say, we're going to talk about this in a minute, and this is real important, watch for it. Then when we get to it, I don't point it out. I'm sorry. If I've done that, and you haven't seen what I meant, or if you think I've left something dangling that I didn't realize I left dangling, you ask me about it. Because we're here to learn. All of us here to learn. I've learned already this meeting some things I didn't know. And that's not all. I'll learn some more. So if there's something that I've confused you on, or something I have left out, or something you felt like should have been put in, let me know this afternoon. And we'll try to correct those matters and get them straightened out. But again, thanks so much for your interest. Nobody's gone to sleep. You've shown very good attention. You're taking notes, and I commend you for it, and I feel honored because of it. And, of course, we all, again, ought to be honored because God seemed fit to reveal to us the marvelous, beautiful truths we find in these books of prophecy.